Side 6, The Boat of a Million Years by Powell Anderson. Continuing on page 159. Seated, he lifted a hand in benison.
Welcome, he said in the hill dialect. May the spirits guide you along the way.
His gaze was shrewd.
Do you wish to make offering?
She bowed low. I am a poor wanderer, master. He smiled.
So they have told me. Fear not. Most who come here believe gifts will win them the favor of the gods. Well, if it helps uplift their souls, they are right. But the seeking soul itself is the only real sacrifice. Be seated, Lady Lee, and let us come to know each other.
As the elders had instructed her, she knelt on the mat near his feet. His look searched her.
You do that otherwise than any woman I have seen before, he murmured. And you talk differently, too.
I am but newly in these parts, master.
I mean that you do not talk like a lowlander who has picked up some of the Highland form of speech.
I thought I had learned more than one Chinese tongue well, as long as I have been in the Middle Kingdom, broke from her.
I've been widely about myself.
He shifted to the idiom of Shaanxi or Honan, though it was not quite what she remembered from the wealthy, populous northeastern provinces, and he used it rustily.
Will you be more at ease talking this?
I learned it first, master.
It's been long since I... But where are you from, then?
She raised her face toward his. Her heart fluttered. With an effort like reining in a wild horse, she kept her voice level.
Master, I was born across the sea, in the country of Nippon.
His eyes widened.
You have come far in your search for salvation. Far and long, master.
She drew breath. Her mouth had gone dry.
I was born 400 years ago.
What? He leaped to his feet.
She rose too. It is true, she said desperately. How could I dare lie to you? The enlightenment I seek have sought, oh, that was to find someone like myself, who never grows old.
She could hold back the tears no more. He laid his arms around her. She clung close and felt how he also trembled. After a time they drew apart and, for another while, stared at one another. The wind boomed outside. A strange calm had fallen on her. She blinked her lashes clear and told him,
You have only my word for this, of course. I learned quite early to be nobody that anybody was much concerned about or would especially remember. I believe you, he answered hoarsely. Your presence, you, a foreigner and a woman, that speaks for you. And I think I am afraid to disbelieve you.
A laugh sobbed.
You will have time aplenty to make certain.
Time, he mumbled.
Hundreds, thousands of years. And you, a woman.
Old fears awoke. Her hands fluttered before her. She forced herself to stand where she was.
I am a nun. I took vows to Amida Butsu, the Buddha.
He nodded, again straining muscles.
How else could you travel freely?
I was not always safe, she wrung out of her lips. I have been violated in wild lands of this realm, nor have I always been true. I have sometimes taken shelter with a man who offered it and stayed with him till he died.
I'll be kind, he promised.
I know, I asked, of certain women here, but what of those vows? I thought I had no choice before, but now... His laughter gusted louder than needful.
Oh, I release you from them.
Can you?
I am the master, am I not? The people aren't supposed to pray to me, but I know they do, more than to their gods. Nothing bad has come of it. Instead, we've had peace, lifetime after lifetime.
Did you foresee that? He shrugged.
No. Myself, I am maybe 1,500 years old. I don't remember just when I came here.
The past took possession of him. He looked beyond her and the wall. He spoke low and rapidly.
The years blur together. They become one. The dead are as real as the living, and the living as unreal as the dead. For a while long ago, I was mad, in a waking dream. Some monks took me in, and slowly, I'm not sure how, slowly I grew able to think again. Ah, I see that something like that happened to you, too. Well, for me, it still is often hard to be sure what I truly remember, and I forget much. I had found, like you, the safest thing was to be a footloose religious person. I only meant to stay here a few years after they'd made me welcome, but time went on and on. This was a snug den, and foes feared to come, once word of me had drifted about. And what else, what better, was there? I've tried to do my people no harm. I think they think I do them good. He shook himself, trod forward, caught both her hands. His were big, strong, but less hard than other men's. She had heard that he lived off their labor, at most diverting himself with his ancient trade of blacksmith. But who are you, Lee? What are you? In sudden weariness she sighed. I have borne many names, Okura, Asagao, Yukiko. Names did not matter among us. They changed as our positions changed, and we might use a different nickname for every friend. I was an attendant at a court that became a shadow, when no more pretense of being mortal was possible, and I feared to proclaim what I was. I turned nun and begged my way from shrine to shrine, place to place. It was easier for me, he admitted, but I too found I'd better keep moving and stay clear of anybody powerful who might want me to linger, until I found this haven. How did you come to leave Nippon, you call that land? I was forever hoping to find someone like me, an end to the loneliness, the meaninglessness. For I had tried to find meaning in the Buddha, and no enlightenment ever came. Well, the news reached us that the Mongols, they who had conquered China and tried to invade us, but the divine wind wrecked their ships, they had been driven out. The Chinese were sailing far and wide, also to us. This land is our motherland in spirit, the mother of civilization. She saw puzzlement and recalled that he was of lowly birth and had lived withdrawn since before she came into the world. We knew of many holy sites in China. I thought as well there, if anywhere, would be other immortals. So I took passage as a pilgrim. The captain gained merit by carrying me, and on these shores I set off afoot. I did not then know how vast the country is. Have you never wished to go home? What is home? Besides, the Chinese have stopped sailing. They have destroyed all their great ships. It is forbidden on pain of death to leave the empire. You had not heard? We're free of overlords here. Welcome. Welcome. His tone deepened, strengthened. He let go her hands and once more laid arms about her waist, but now the clasp was strong and his breath turned musky. You found me. We're together. You, my wife. I waited and waited, prayed, offered, cast spells, till at last I gave up hope. Then you came. Lee. His mouth sought hers. She turned her cheek, protested faintly. No, this was too fast, unseemly. He paid no heed. It was not an assault, but it was an overwhelming. She surrendered as she might have surrendered to a storm or a dream. While he had her, she tried to bring her thoughts under control. Afterward, he was drowsy and gentle for a while, then wildly merry. 3. Winter struck with blinding snow on wind that rampaged among the houses and stretched fingers through every crack round door or shutter. The calm that followed was so cold that silence seemed to ring, with stars uncountable above a white hardness that gave back their glitter. Folk went into the weather no more than they needed to tend their livestock and get fuel. At home they crouched over tiny hearth fires or stepped the hours away within heaped sheepskins. Lee felt sick. She always did in the mornings during the first part of a pregnancy. That she had become fruitful was no surprise, as often as Dushan lay with her. Nor did she regret it. He meant well, and bit by bit, without letting him know what happened, she schooled him in what pleased her, until sometimes she too flew off into joy and came back down to lie happily wearied in the warmth and odor of him. and this child they had gotten together might also be ageless. Still, she wished she could exult over it as he did. On her best days, she was free of forebodings, no more. If only she had something to do. At least in Heian-kyo there had been color, music, the round of ceremonies, the often vicious but oftener titillating intrigues. At least on the road there had been changing landscape, changing people, unsureness, small victories over trouble or danger or despair. Here she could, if she liked, weave the same cloths, cook the same meals, sweep the same floors, empty the same muck buckets, though the disciples expected to do the menial tasks, and swap the same and the same words with women whose minds ranged as far as next year's kitchen gardening. Their men took interest in a little more than that, some of them, though not much more. However, they felt ill at ease with her. They knew her for the chosen of the master and accorded her respect in a clumsy fashion. Yet they also knew her for a woman, and she was soon taken for granted, sacred, but a part of everyday life, like Dushan, and women did not sit in the councils of men. Lee gathered that this was no great loss to her. One day of that winter stood forth in memory, an island at the middle of an abyss that swallowed all the rest. The door swung open on dazzlingly sunlit, blue-shadowed drifts. A wave of chill poured through. Dushan's bulk blotted the light. He entered and closed the door. Gloom clapped down again. "Whew!" he whinnied, stamping the snow off his boots. "Cold enough to freeze a fire solid and the anvil with it." She must have heard him say that 100 times, and a few other favorite expressions. Lee looked up from the mat on which she knelt. Bright spots danced before her. They were due to reflection off the brass chest, which the disciples worshipfully kept polished. She had been staring at it for an hour, 2 hours, while sunken in the half-doze that was her retreat from these empty months. A thought smote. The suddenness of it made her catch her breath. Next she wondered why it had not occurred to her before, then supposed that was because the newness of this life had driven everything else out of her mind until the life went stale. And she was saying, "Horseshoe," the pet name she had given him, "I have never looked in yonder box." His mouth was open. He had been about to speak. He left it hanging thus for a moment before he replied slowly, "Why, those are the books. And scrolls, yes, scrolls. The holy writings." Eagerness thrilled through her. "May I see them?" "They're not for, ordinary eyes." She rose and told him fiercely, "I, too, am immortal. Have you forgotten?" "Oh, no, no." He waved his hands, a vague gesture. "But you're a woman. You can't read them." Lee's mind leaped back across centuries. Ladies of the court in Heian-kyo were literate in the vernacular, but seldom in Chinese. That was the classical language which only men could properly comprehend. Nevertheless, she had contrived to study the writing, and sometimes in China had found a chance, a span of rest in a tranquil place, to refresh that knowledge. Moreover, these texts were most likely Buddhist. That faith had intermingled here with Taoism and primitive animism. She would recognize passages. "I can," she said. He gaped. "You can?" He shook his head. "Well, the gods have singled you out. Yes, look at them if you want, but handle them carefully. They're quite old." Joyful, she went to the chest and opened it. At first she saw it only full of shadow. She fetched the lamp and held it above. Wan light flickered and fell. The chest gaped across rot, mildew, and fungus. She moaned. Barely did she keep from letting hot grease spill onto the corruption. With her free hand she groped, caught hold of something, lifted a gray tatter up to view. Dushan bent over. "Well, well," he muttered. "Water must have gotten in. How sad." She dropped the shred, replaced the lamp, rose to confront him. "When did you last look into that box?" she demanded most quietly. His glance shifted elsewhere. "I don't know. No reason to." "You never read the sacred texts? You have them perfectly by heart. They were gifts from pilgrims. What are they to me?
He summoned bluster.
I don't need writings. I am the master. That's enough.
You cannot read or write, she said.
They suppose I can, and what harm, I asked you.
He turned on her.
Stop nagging me. Go. Go into the other rooms. Leave me be.
Pity overcame her. He was, after all, so vulnerable. A simple man, a common man, whom karma or the gods or the demons or blind accident had made ageless for no knowable reason. With peasant shrewdness he had survived. He had acquired the sonorous phrases that a saint should utter, and he had not abused his position here. He was a god figure that required little and returned much, assurance, protection, oneness. But the unchanging cycle of season after season after season, world without end, had dulled his wits and even, she saw, sapped his courage.
"I'm sorry," she said, laying a hand on his. "I meant no reproach. I'll tell nobody, of course. I'll clean this out and from now on take care of such things for you. For us."
"Thank you," he replied uncomfortably. "Still, well, I meant to tell you you'll have to stay in the back rooms till nightfall."
"A woman is coming to you," she said in a voice as leaden as the knowledge.
"They expect it."
His own voice loudened.
"So it's been since the beginning. What else was there for me? I can't suddenly withhold my blessing from their households, can I?"
"And she's young and pretty."
"Well, when they aren't, I've been kind to them anyhow."
He forced indignation.
"Who are you to call me faithless? How many men have you been with in your time, and you a nun?"
"I said nothing against you." She turned around. "Very well, I go." She felt his relief like radiance at her back. The four disciples huddled together in one room of their quarters, blurs of darkness by lamplight, and played a game with sticks tossed on the floor. They sprang to their feet when Lee entered, bowed awkwardly, stood in abashed silence. They knew quite well why she was here, but could not think what to say. How young they were, she thought, and how handsome Juan, at least, was. She imagined his body on hers, lithe, hot, delirious. Perhaps later. There would be boundless later. She smiled at them. "The master wants me to rehearse you in the Diamond Sutra," she told them. 4. It was raining when the village buried the first child of the master and the lady. They had hoped for sunshine, but the wizard and the tiny corpse both told them they could not auspiciously wait longer than they had done. Spring that year had come late. Its bleakness and damp stretched on into the summer. They slipped through to the lungs of the girl child, who gasped for a few days before she lay still, oh, very still, when she cried and sucked and snuggled no more. With Dushan, Lee watched the wizard lower the coffin into a hole where water sloshed. The disciples stood close, the rest of the people in a rough ring. Beyond them she saw mists, shadowy hints of hillside, grandeur dissolved in this formless gray that tapped on her face and dripped off her hat and weighted her hair. Wet wool stank. Her breasts ached with milk. The wizard rose, took up the rattle tucked under his rope belt, and shook it as he pranced around the grave, screaming. Thus he warded off evil spirits. The disciples and those few others who had prayer wheels spun them. Everybody swayed to and fro. The chant sounded as raw as the air. "Honored ancestors, great souls! Honored ancestors, great souls!" Over and over, rite of a heathendom that the Tao and the Buddha had barely touched. Dushan raised his arms and intoned words more fitting, but blurred and mechanical. He had spoken them too often. Lee hardly noticed. She likewise had known too many deaths. She could not at the moment count the number of infants she had born and lost. 7, 8, 12. It hurt more to watch children grow old.
But farewell, daughter of mine. May you not be lonely and afraid wherever you have gone. What Lee felt now was the final hard freezing of resolution within herself. Things ended. Folk mumbled words and went back to their work. The wizard remained. His task was to fill the grave. At her back, through his ongoing quavery song, Lee heard clods fall on the coffin. The disciples sought their parents' homes for the nonce. Lee and Dushan entered an empty house. He left the door ajar for light. Coals aglow on the hearth had somewhat warmed the room. He shucked his coat and tossed it on the bed. A sigh gusted from him. "Well," he said, "that's done." After a span, into her silence. "The poor wee girl. But it happens. Better luck next time, eh? And maybe a son." She tensed. "There will be no next time, here," she answered. "What?" He lumbered around to stand before her. His arms dangled at his sides. She met his stare full on. "I will not stay," she told him. "You should leave with me." "Are you crazed?" Fear crossed the usually firm countenance. "Has a demon gotten into you?" She shook her head. "Only an understanding, and it has been growing for months. This is simply no life for us." "It's peaceful. It's happy." "So you see it, because you've lain in it so long. I say it is stagnant and squalid." She spoke calmly, the least bit sadly. "At first, yes, after my wanderings, I believed I had come to a sanctuary." Dushan. She would not give him his endearment name until he yielded, if ever he did. "I have learned what you should have seen an age ago. Earth holds no sanctuaries for anyone, anywhere." Amazement made his anger faint. "You want back to your palaces and monkey quarters, eh?" "No, that was another trap. I want freedom, to be, to become whatever I am able to, whatever we are able to." "They need me here." She must first put down scorn. If she showed hers for these half-animals, she could well lose him. And true, in his liking for them, his concern and compassion, he was better than she was. Second, she must muster all the will at her command. If she surrendered and abided, she would likewise slowly become one with the hill folk. That might aid her toward selflessness, toward ultimate release from the wheel, but she would give up every imaginable attainment that this life held. What escape, except through random violence, did she have from it? "They lived much the same before you," she said. "They will do so after you, and with or without you it cannot be for always. The Han people press westward. I have seen them clearing forest and breaking earth. Some day they will take these lands." He fell into bewilderment. "Where can we go? Would you be a beggar again?" "If need be, but then only for a short while. Dushan, a whole world lies beyond this horizon. We know nothing about it. I know something." Through the ice of her resolve shone a strengthening fire. "Foreign ships touch the shores of China. Barbarians thrust inward. I have heard about mighty stirrings to the south, on the far side of the mountains." "You told me it's forbidden to leave the empire. Ha, what does that mean to us? What watchmen stand on those paths we can find? I tell you, if we cannot seize the opportunities that beckon everywhere around, we do not deserve our lives. If we become famous, they would notice we don't grow old. We can cope with that. Change rushes through the world unbridled. The empire can no more stay forever locked into itself than this village can. We'll find advantages to take. Perhaps just setting money out at interest for a long time. We'll see. My years have been harder than yours. I know how full of secret places chaos is. Yes, we may well go under. We may perish. But until then we will have been wholly alive." He stood dazed. she knew she would need months wherein to prevail, if indeed she could. Well, she had the patience of centuries to draw upon, when there was something for which to work. Clouds thinned, light broke through. The rain in the doorway gleamed like flying arrows. 5. Springtime came back, and that year it was mild, overwhelmingly bright, full of fragrances, and the cries of wildfowl returned. Gorged with snow-melt, the stream sprang white amidst hillside leaves, brawled through the dell, plunged into the bamboo forest, bound for the great river, and so at last the sea. A man and a woman followed it on the road. They were clad for travel. Staves swung in their hands. On his back was a load of needful goods. On hers, a swaddled baby boy, who gurgled lustily and happily as he looked around him at wonders. The people stood gathered together behind, where their homes came to an end, and wept. Chapter 11 The Kitten and the Cardinal. Armand Jean du Plessis de Richelieu, Cardinal of the Church, first minister to His Most Christian Majesty Louis XIII, who had created him duke, gave his visitor a long regard. The man was altogether out of place in this chamber of blue and gilt elegance. Though decently clad for a commoner, he seemed unmistakably the seafarer he proclaimed himself. Of medium height, he had the suppleness of youth, and the dark, hawk face was unlined. But something about him, perhaps the alert steadiness of the look he gave back, bespoke a knowledge of the world such as it takes many years and many corners to gain. Windows stood open to summer fragrances blowing from the fields and woodlands of Poitou. The river Mable clucked past an ancestral castle lately rebuilt as a modern palace. Sunlight, reflected off the water, danced in shards among the cherubs and ancient heroes that adorned the ceiling. At a little distance from the cardinal's throne-like chair, a kitten played with its shadow across the parquetry. Richelieu's thin fingers stroked the parchment on his lap. Its age-spotted dun made his robe appear blood-bright. For this meeting he had put on full canonicals, as though to shield against demons, but when he spoke his voice held its wonted wintry calm. "If this be not falsified, today shall perhaps see the strangest audience I have ever granted." Jacques Lacy bowed with more grace than would have been awaited. "I thank your eminence for it, and assure him all is true." His speech was not quite of the region, nor of any in France. Did it still bear a lilt of Ireland, or of some land farther yet? Certainly it showed that, if not formally educated, he had read many books. Where did a skipper plying between the old world and the new find time? "You may thank the bishop who prevailed upon me," said Richelieu dryly. "After the priest of Saint Félix had prevailed upon another, your eminence. You are a bold one indeed, Captain Lacy." "Have a care. This matter is dangerous enough already." "I humbly beg your eminence's pardon." The tone was by no means insolent, but neither was it contrite. "Well, let us get on with your business." Even away from Paris, hours were precious, and the future might not hold a large store of them. Nevertheless, Richelieu considered for a minute, stroking the beard that brought the gauntness of his features to a point before ordering, "Describe exactly what you said to the priest and caused him to do." Surprise slightly shook Lacy's self-command. "Your eminence knows." "I will compare the accounts," Richelieu sighed, "and you may spare the honorifics hereafter. We are alone. I thank your—" "Well," the mariner drew breath. "I sought him out at his church in Saint-Nazaire after I heard that Monsieur would grace these parts, no enormous distance to travel from there, with his presence for a while. I told him of the casket. Rather, I reminded him, for he knew about it in a half-forgotten way. Naturally, that caught his attention, for nobody else remembered. It had simply gathered dust in the crypt these past 400 years." The kitten pounced at Lacy's foot. A smile in its direction flickered across the cardinal's lips. His eyes, huge and feverishly luminous, turned back to the man.
"Did you relate how it came to be there?" he pursued.
"Certainly, monsieur. That was evidence for my good faith, since the story had not become part of folklore."
"Do so again. Ah, in those days, a Breton trader named Pierre, of Plamanac, settled in Saint-Nazaire. It was hardly more than a village, not that it's major these days, as Monsieur doubtless knows, but on that account a house cost little, and the location was handy for the small coastwise vessel he acquired. Men could more easily change their homes and trades then than now. Pierre prospered modestly, married, raised children. At last, widowed, he declared he'd enlist in the crusade, the final one, as it turned out, that King Louis the Saint was launching. By that time he was old, but remarkably well-preserved. Many people said he still looked downright youthful. He was never seen afterward, and folk supposed he had died. Before he left, he made a substantial donation to the parish church. That was common when someone was about to go on a long journey, let alone off to war. However, to this gift he attached a condition. The church was to keep a box for him. He showed the priest that it contained nothing more than a rolled-up parchment, a document of some importance and confidentiality, whereupon he sealed it. One day he or an heir would return to claim it, and the parchment itself would validate that claim. Well, a request of this kind was not unheard of, and the priest duly entered it in the annals. Lifetimes went by. When I appeared, I expected I'd have to find the record for today's priest, but he's an antiquarian and had browsed through the books. Richelieu lifted the parchment and read it for perhaps the seventh time, repeatedly glancing at Lacey. "Yes," he murmured. "This declares that the rightful heir will look just like Pierre de Plamanac, whatever name he bears, and describes him in full. Excellently crafted, that description."
The cardinal fancied himself a man of letters and had written and produced several dramas.
"Furthermore, there is this verse in supposed nonsense syllables that the claimant will be able to recite without looking at the text." "Shall I do so for monsieur?"
"No need, thus far. You did for the priest, and later for his bishop. The proof was sufficient that he, in turn, wrote to the bishop of this diocese, persuading him to persuade me to see you. For the document concludes by declaring that the heir will carry tidings of the utmost importance. Now, why did you refuse any hint of their nature to either prelate? They are only for the greatest man in the land."
"That is His Majesty."
The visitor shrugged.
"What chance would I have of admission to the king? Rather, I'd be arrested on suspicion of almost anything, and my knowledge tortured out of me. Your Eminence is known to be more, flexible, of an inquiring mind. You patronize learned and literary men. You founded a national academy. You've rebuilt and generously endowed the Sorbonne. And as for political achievements—"
His words trailed off while he waved his hands. Clearly he thought of the Huguenots, curbed, yet kept conciliated, of the powers of the nobles patiently chipped down, until now their feudal castles were for the most part demolished, of the cardinal's rivals at court outwitted, defeated, some exiled or executed, of the long war against the imperialists, in which France, with Protestant Sweden, the ally that Richelieu obtained, was finally getting the upper hand. Who really ruled this country? Richelieu raised his brows. "You are very well informed for a humble sea captain."
"I have had to be, monsieur," replied Lacey quietly.
Richelieu nodded. "You may be seated." Lacey bowed once more and fetched a lesser chair, which he placed before the large one at a respectful distance, and lowered himself. He sat back, seemingly at ease, but a discerning eye recognized readiness to explode into instant action. Not that there was any danger. guards stood just outside the door.
"What is this news you bear?"
Richelieu asked. Lacy frowned.
"I do not expect your eminence to believe upon first hearing it. I gamble my life on the supposition that you will bear with me, and will dispatch trusty men to bring you the further evidence I can provide."
The kitten frolicked about his ankles.
"Charlot likes you,"
the cardinal remarked, a tinge of warmth in his voice. Lacy smiled.
"They say monsieur is fond of cats." "While they are young."
"Go on.
Let me see what you know about them. It will tell me something about you."
Lacy leaned forward and tickled the kitten around the ears. It extended tiny claws and swarmed up his stockings. He helped it to his lap, chucked it under the chin, and stroked the soft fur.
"I've had cats myself," he said, "afloat and ashore. They were sacred to the ancient Egyptians. They drew the chariot of the Norse goddess of love. They're often called familiars of witches, but that's nonsense. Cats are what they are, and never try, like dogs, to be anything else. I suppose that's why we humans find them mysterious, and some of us fear or hate them, while some others like them better than their fellow men, God forgive."
The cardinal crossed himself in perfunctory fashion.
"You are a remarkable man, Captain Lacy." "In my way, monsieur, which is quite different from yours."
Richelieu's gaze intensified.
"I obtained a report on you, of course, when I heard of your wish,"
he said slowly.
"But tell me about your past life in your own words, that you may judge them, and me, monsieur."
The mariner's look went afar, while his right hand continued as the kitten's playmate.
"Well, then, I'll tell it in a curious way. You'll soon understand the reason for that, which is that I do not want to lie to you. Seamus Lacy hails from Northern Ireland. He can't readily say when he was born, for the baptismal record is back there if it's not been destroyed. But on the face of it, he must be around 50 years old. In the year 1611, the English king cleared the Irish from the best parts of Ulster and settled it with Scottish Protestants. Lacy was among those who left the country. He took a bit of money along, for he came of a mildly well-to-do seafaring family. In Nantes he found refuge with old established Irish trading folk, who helped him regularize his status. He took the French form of his Christian name, became a French subject, and married a French woman. Being a sailor, he made long voyages as far as Africa, the West Indies, and New France. Eventually he rose to shipmaster. He has 4 children alive, their ages from 13 to 5, but his wife died 2 years ago, and he has not remarried. And when he heard that I would be in Poitou for several weeks, he went downstream to Saint-Nazaire and opened the casket that his ancestor had left in the church," Richelieu said low. Lacy looked straight at him. "Thus it is, Your Eminence. Presumably you always knew about it."
"Obviously I did."
"Although you are Irish, and no member of your family claimed the thing for 4 centuries. You yourself lived almost 30 years in nearby Nantes before you did."
"Why?"
"I had to be sure of the situation. At that, the decision was hard." "The report states that you have an associate, a red-headed man with a missing hand, who goes by the name of McMahon. Lately he has disappeared. Why?"
"No disrespect intended, Your Eminence, but I sent him off because I couldn't foresee what would come of this, and it was wrong to risk his life also."
Lacy smiled. The kitten tumbled about his wrist.
"Besides, he's an uncouth sort. What if he gave offense?"
He paused.
"I took care not to know just where he's gone. He'll find out whether I've returned safely home." "You show a distrustfulness that is scarcely friendly." "On the contrary, monsieur, I'm putting a faith in you that I've put in none but my comrade for a very long time. I stake everything on the belief that you will not immediately assume I'm a madman, an enemy agent, or a sorcerer."
Richelieu gripped the arms of his chair. Despite the robe, it could be seen how his wasted frame tautened. His eyes never wavered. "What, then, are you?" he asked tonelessly. "I am Jacques Lacy from Ireland, Your Eminence," the visitor replied with the same levelness. "The only real falsehood about that is that I was born there, for I was not. I did not spend more than a century in it. Outside the English-held parts, people have a large enough measure of freedom that it's rather easy to change lives. But I fear they are all doomed to conquest, and the plantation of Ulster gave me an unquestionable reason for departing. I came back to where I had once been, Pierre de Plamenac, who was not a Breton-born. Before and after him I've used other names, lived in other places, pursued other trades. It's been my way of surviving through the millennia." Breath hissed between teeth. "This is not a total surprise to me. Since I first heard from the bishop, I have been thinking, are you the wandering Jew?" The head shook. The kitten sensed tension and crouched. "I know about rascals who pretended they were him. No, monsieur, I was alive when our Lord was on earth, but never saw him, nor knew about him till much later. Once in a while I have passed myself off as a Jew, because that was safest or simplest. But it was pretense, same as when I've been a Mussulman." The mouth formed a grim grin. "For those roles I had to get circumcised. The skin slowly grew back. On my kind, unless a wound is as great as the loss of a hand, it heals without scars." "I must think anew." Richelieu closed his eyes. Presently his lips moved. They shaped the Paternoster and the Ave, while his fingers drew the cross over and over. Yet when he was done and looked back upon the world, down at the parchment, he spoke almost matter-of-factly. "I saw at once that the verse here is not actually nonsense. It bears a certain resemblance to Hebraic, transcribed in Roman letters, but it is different." "What?" "Ancient Phoenician, Your Eminence. I was born in Tyre when Hiram was its king. I'm not sure whether David or Solomon was reigning in Jerusalem just then." Again Richelieu closed his eyes. 2.5 millennia ago," he whispered. He opened them wide. "Recite the verse. I want to hear that language." Lacy obeyed. The rapid guttural words rang through sounds of wind and water, through the silence that filled the chamber. The kitten sprang off his lap and pattered to a corner. Stillness prevailed for half a minute before Richelieu asked, "What does it mean?" "A fragment of a song. The sort men sang in taverns or when camped ashore during a voyage. Black as the sky of night is my woman's hair. Bright as the stars are her eyes. Round and white as the moon her breasts. And she moves like Ashtoreth's sea. Would that my sight and my hands and myself lay upon all." "I'm sorry it's so profane, monsieur. It was what I could remember. And at that, I had to reconstruct it." Richelieu quirked a smile. "Yes, I dare say one forgets much in thousands of years. And in Pierre's day, clerics, too, were less refined than they are now." Shrewdly, "Though did you expect that something like this would go a little way toward authenticating you, since it is the kind of thing that would stick in a man's mind?" "I am not lying to Your Eminence. In no particular." "In that case, you have been a liar throughout the ages." Lacy spread his palms. "What would monsieur have had me do? Imagine, if you please, even in this most enlightened of eras and countries, imagine I proclaimed myself openly. At best, I'd be taken for a mountebank and be lucky to escape with a scourging. I could easily go to the galleys or hang. At worst, I'd be condemned as a sorcerer, in league with Satan, and burned. Evil would befall me without my saying a word if I just stayed in one place, living on while they buried my sons and grandsons, and I never showed signs of age. Oh, I've met folk, Many live at this moment in the new world, for whom I could be a holy man or a god. But they've been savages, and I prefer civilization. Besides, civilization sooner or later overruns the savages. No, best I arrive at a new home as a plausible outsider, settle down a few decades, and at last move onward in such wise that people take for granted I've died.
What brought this fate upon you? Richelieu signed himself anew.
God alone knows, Your Eminence. I'm no saint, but I don't believe I was ever an especially terrible sinner. And yes, I am baptized.
When was that?
About 1,200 years ago.
Who converted you?
I'd been a Christian catechumen a long time, but customs changed and... May I ask leave to defer telling how it happened?
Why? Demanded Richelieu.
Because I must convince Your Eminence that I'm telling the truth, and in this case the truth looks too much like invention.
Before those eyes, Lacey broke off, threw up his hands, laughed, and said, Very well, if you insist.
It was in Britain after the Romans were gone, at the court of a warlord. They called him Reothamus, their high king, but mainly he had some cataphracts. With them he staved off the English invaders. His name was Artorius.
Richelieu sat motionless.
Oh, I was no knight of his, merely a trader who came by on my rounds, Lacey stated. Nor did I meet any Lancelot or Gawain or Galahad or any glittering Camelot. Little of Rome lingered there. In fact, it's only my guess that this was the seed corn of the Arthur legend. But Monsieur will understand why I was reluctant to mention it at all. I was tempted to concoct a prosaic falsehood.
Richelieu nodded.
I do understand. If you continue a liar, you are as skillful a one as I have found in a wide experience.
He forbore to inquire whether the Phoenician had embraced Christ out of expediency, the same as when he did homage to numerous other gods.
Lacey's tone became wry. I shan't insult you by denying that I've given a great deal of beforehand thought to this interview.
Richelieu plucked the parchment from his lap and cast it to the floor. It struck with a small rattling noise that drew the notice of the kitten. So much of a bodily gesture did the cardinal permit himself. He leaned forward, fingertips pressed together. Sunlight glistened off a great ring of gold and emerald.
"What do you want from me?"
he snapped.
"Your protection, monsieur," Lacey replied, "for myself and any like me."
Color came and went in his lean cheeks above the closely trimmed beard, which had not a single silver hair.
"Who are they?"
"McMahon is one, as Your Eminence must have guessed," Lacey told him. "We met in France when it was still Gaul. I've encountered or heard of three more whom I wondered about, but death by mischance took them before I could be certain, and another I did feel sure of, but that person disappeared. Our kind must be very rare and shy of revealing themselves."
"Vanishingly rare, as the learned Dr. Descartes might put it," said Richelieu with a flash of bleak humor. "Some, over the centuries, may have tried to do what I'm trying this day, and come to grief. No record of them would likely remain if any was ever made."
The kitten advanced cautiously toward the parchment. Richelieu sat back. Lacey had stayed well nigh immobile, hands folded on the sober-hued knee breeches.
"What more evidence have you to offer?" the cardinal asked.
Lacey gazed away at nothing visible.
"I thought about this for lifetimes before I took the first measures."
His voice was methodical.
"One gets into the habit of taking forethought and biding one's time. Perhaps too much so. Perhaps opportunities slip by and it's again too late. But one has learned, sometimes at a high price, monsieur, one has learned that this world is dangerous and nothing in it abides. Kings and nations, popes and gods, no irreverence meant, all go down in the dust or up in the flames all too soon. I have my provisions, piecemeal made over the centuries, hoards buried here and there, tricks for changing identities, a tool-chest of assorted skills, and my reliquaries. They are not all in churches, nor are they all of them caskets containing parchments. But throughout Europe, northern Africa, hither Asia, lie the tokens I planted whenever I could. My idea was that if and when a hope came along, I'd go to the nearest of those caches and retrieve what it held. That should give me my opening wedge. Now, if Your Eminence likes, I can describe quite a few that will be accessible to his agents. I can say exactly what the nature of each is and where it reposes. In several cases, at least, it will definitely have been there for a long while. In every case, they can verify that Captain Jacques Lacey could not possibly have made the arrangements at any time in the half-century that men have known him. Richelieu stroked his beard. "And meanwhile you expect to wait in custody, hostage to this material," he murmured. "Yes. I have little doubt that it exists, for you show no signs of madness. Therefore you cannot be an impostor, either, of any sort known to criminal justice, unless indeed you really are a sorcerer or an actual demon." A film of sweat shone on Lacey's brow, though he responded steadily. "Holy water or exorcism won't hurt me. You could have me put to the question. You'd find me healing quite fast from anything that didn't kill or totally mutilate. I came here because everything I could find out made me think you are too wise. I do not say merciful, monsieur. I say wise, enlightened, intelligent, to resort to that. Others will urge me to do so. Your Eminence has the power to refuse them. That's another reason why I sought you. I've waited centuries for such a man at such a crux in history." The kitten arrived at the parchment, reached out, patted it. Curled back into a loose roll, it rustled and moved. Delighted, the kitten bounced to and fro. Richelieu's look smoldered. "Have you never before had a protector?" Lacey sighed. "Once, monsieur, about 300 years after my birth in Egypt." "Tell me." "Like a number of Phoenicians," I'd resumed that nationality, "I sailed in the service of Pharaoh Psammetich. You may have read of him under the name Psammeticus. He chanced to be strong and wise, like you, a man who saved his country from disaster and made it once more secure. Oh, I'd planned nothing except to depart in my usual way when the time came. But it also chanced this king lived long, reigning for more than 50 years, and I, well, it was a good service I was in. And when my first Egyptian wife died, I married another, and we were uncommonly happy. So I lingered till the king saw past the mannerisms by which I feigned encroaching age. He persuaded me to confide in him and took me under his wing. To him I was sacred, chosen by the gods for some purpose unknown, but surely high. He set inquiries afoot throughout his realm, and as far abroad as possible. Nothing came of them. As I said, my kind must be very rare. What finally happened? Psammetich died. His son Nico succeeded him, and had no love for me, nor hatred, I suppose. But most of the priests and courtiers did, seeing me as a threat to their positions. It grew plain that I wouldn't last in the royal compound. If nothing else, an assassin would get me. But the new king denied me leave to go. I think he feared what I might be able to do. Well, talk rose about dispatching a Phoenician crew to try sailing around Africa. I used what little influence was left me to help make that come about, and be named to it. An immortal man might prove valuable in unknown countries. Lacey shrugged. At the first opportunity, I jumped ship and made my way to Europe. I never found out whether the expedition succeeded. Herodotus said it did, but he was often careless about his information. And I assume any record of you in Egypt has decayed, if your enemies didn't expunge it, Richelieu said. Not that we can read those glyphs. Please understand, monsieur, Lacey urged. I've seldom been in the presence of greatness. Psammetich, Artorius, 2 or 3 others,
but usually insignificantly. And now, Your Eminence, I've glimpsed more, but only when I was in a crowd. It's almost always been wisest to stay obscure. Besides, I'm just an old sailor with nothing special to offer. Eagerly, accept my memories. Think what I can mean to scholars, and if under your protection I draw other immortals to us, think, my lord, what that will mean to France. Silence fell again, except for the wind, the river, a ticking clock, and the kitten that made a toy of the parchment. Richelieu brooded. Lacey waited. At last the cardinal said, "What do you truly want of me?" "I told you, monsieur, your protection, the place in your service, the proclamation of what I am, and the promise that anyone like me can come to the same safe harbor. Every rogue in Europe will swarm here. I'll know what questions to ask if your learned men don't." Yes, I dare say you will. After you've made a few examples, that nuisance should end." Lacey hesitated. "Not that I can foretell what the immortals will each prove to be like. I've admitted my McMahon is a crude sort. The other, whom I was sure of, is, or has been, a prostitute, if she still lives. One survives as best one can. But some may well be decent, or repent. Some may in truth be holy. Hermits, perhaps?" Richelieu's momentarily dreamy tone sharpened. "You have not sought for any new patron after that Egyptian king more than 2,000 years ago? I told Your Eminence, one grows wary. Why have you now at last let down your guard?" "In part because of you," Lacey answered at once. "Your Eminence hears much flattery. I needn't go into detail about what's the plain truth. I've already spoken it. But you, by yourself, wouldn't have been enough. It's also that I dare hope the times are right." The parchment jammed against a leg of the chair of state and resisted further attempts. The kitten mewed. Richelieu looked down and half reached. "Does my lord wish—" Lacey sprang to pick up the animal and proffer it. Richelieu took the small, fuzzy form in both hands and placed it on his lap where the parchment had rested. Lacey bowed and resumed his seat. "Continue," the cardinal said while he caressed his pet. "I have watched the course of things as well as a man can who's in the middle of them," Lacey said. "I've read books and listened to philosophers and to common folk with native wit. I've thought. Immortality is lonely, monsieur. One has much time for thinking. It seems to me that in the past 2 or 3 centuries a change has been coming upon the world, not just the rise or fall of another empire, a change as great as the change from boy to man, or even worm to butterfly. Mortals feel it, too. They speak of a renaissance that began perhaps 1,400 years after our Lord, but I see it more clearly. Pharaoh Psammetich, how far could his couriers go? How many could they find who'd understand my question that they bore, and not cower from it, ignorant and frightened? And he was as powerful a king as any in his age. The Greeks, the Romans, the Byzantines, the Persians, all the rest, they were little better as regards either knowledge or range. Nor did I ever again have access to a ruler I trusted, nor had I then thought to prepare myself for such a meeting. That came later. Today men have sailed around the globe, and they know it is a globe. The discoveries of such as Copernicus and Galileo—" He saw the slight frown. "Well, be that as it may, men learn marvelous things. Europe goes forth into a whole new hemisphere. At home, for the first time since Rome fell, we begin to have good roads. One can travel swiftly, for the most part safely, over hundreds of leagues. Thousands, once this war is over. Above all, maybe, we have the printing press, and more people every year who can read, who can be reached. At last we can bring the immortals together." Richelieu's fingers amused the kitten, which was becoming drowsy, while his brows again drew downward. "That will take a considerable time," he said. "Oh, yes, as mortals reckon—forgive me, Your Eminence. No matter.
Richelieu coughed. "With none but Charlot to hear, we can speak plainly. Do you indeed believe mankind, here in France, let us say, has attained the security that you found to be such a delusion through all prior history?" Taken aback, Lacey stammered, "No, monsieur, except that I think France will be strong and stable for generations to come, thanks largely to your eminence." Richelieu coughed afresh, his left hand to his mouth, his right reassuring the kitten. "I am not a well man, captain," he said, hoarsened. "I never have been. God may call me at any moment." Lacey's visage took on a somehow remote gentleness. "I know that," he said softly. "May he keep you with us for many years yet, but—" "Nor is the king in good health," Richelieu interrupted. "Finally, finally, he and the queen are blessed with a child, a son, but the prince is not quite 2 years old. About when he was born, I lost Father Joseph, my closest counselor and ablest helper." "I know that also, but you have this Italian-born Mazarin, who's much like you, and whom I am preparing to be my successor." Richelieu's smile writhed. "Yes, you have studied us carefully." "I must. I've learned how during my span on earth, and you too think far ahead." Lacey's words quickened. "I beg you, think. You'll need a while to take this in, as well as to verify my story. I'm amazed how calmly you've heard me out, but an immortal in due course, a gathering of immortals, at the service of the king, today's king, and afterward his son, who should reign long and vigorously. Can you imagine what that will mean to his glory, and so to the glory and power of France?" "No, I cannot," Richelieu snapped, "nor can you, and I have likewise learned wariness. But I tell you, Your Eminence, I can give you evidence." "Silence," Richelieu commanded. He rested left elbow on chair arm, chin on that fist, and stared into space as if beyond the walls, the province, the kingdom. His right hand gently stroked the kitten. It fell asleep, and he took his fingers away. The wind in the river rustled. At last, the clock, on which Phaethon careered desperately in Apollo's runaway sun-chariot, had snipped off almost a quarter of an hour. He stirred and looked back at the other man. Lacey had gone orientally impassive. Now his countenance came alive. The breath shivered in and out of him. "I need not trouble myself with your tokens," Richelieu said heavily. "I assume you are what you assert. It makes no difference." "I beg your eminence's pardon," Lacey whispered. "Tell me," Richelieu went on, and he came to sound nearly amiable, "do you, in the teeth of what you have seen and suffered, do you really believe we have won to a state of things that will endure?" No, Lacey admitted. "No. I think instead everything is changing, everything, and this will go on, and nobody can guess what the end will be, but because of it, we and the generations to come, our lives will be unlike any that ever were lived before. The old bets are off." He paused. "I've grown weary of being homeless. You cannot dream of how weary. I'll snatch at any chance of escape." Richelieu ignored the informal language. Perhaps he did not notice it. He nodded and said, as he might have crooned to one of his pets, "Poor soul, how brave you are to have ventured this, or else, as you say, how weary. But you have just your single life to lose. I have millions." Lacey's head lifted stiffly. "My lord?" "I am responsible for this realm," Richelieu said. "The Holy Father is old and troubled, and never had any gift of statecraft. Thus I am also responsible to a certain extent for the Catholic faith, which is to say Christendom. A good many people think I've given myself over to the devil, and I confess to scorning most scruples, but in the end I am responsible. You see, this is an age of upheaval, but also of hope. You may be right, perhaps, but if so,
You look on it with an immortal eye. I can only, I may only, see the upheaval. War devastating the German lands. The Empire, our enemy, yes, nevertheless, the Holy Roman Empire that Charlemagne founded, bleeding to death. Protestant sect after sect springing up, each with its own doctrine, its own fanaticism. The English growing back to power, the Dutch growing newly to it, voracious and ruthless. Stirrings in Russia, India, China, God knows what in the Americas. Cannon and muskets bringing down the ancient strongholds, the ancient strengths. But what will replace them? To you, the discoveries of the natural philosophers, the books and pamphlets that pour from the printing presses, those are wonders that will bring a new era. I agree. But I, in my position, must ask myself what that era will be like. I must try to cope with it, keep it under control, knowing the entire while that I shall die unsuccessful, and those who come after me will fail. His question lashed. How then dare you suppose I would ever allow, yes, encourage and trumpet the knowledge that persons exist whom old age passes by? Should I, the Dr. Descartes might say, throw yet another wholly unknown and unmanageable factor into an equation already insoluble? Unmanageable. Indeed, that is the right word. The sole certainty I have is that this spark would ignite a thousand new religious lunacies and make peace in Europe impossible for another generation, or worse. No, Captain, whatever you are, he ended, glacial again in the way the world had come to fear. I want no part of you or your immortals. France does not. Lacey sat equally quiet. He had had his reverses often before. May I try to persuade your eminence otherwise over the next few days or years? He asked. You may not. I have too much else to occupy my mind and too damnably little time left for it. Richelieu's manner mildened. Be at ease, he said with half a smile. You shall depart freely. Caution enjoins me to have you arrested and garrotted within this hour. Either you are a charlatan and deserve it, or a mortal danger and require it. However, I deem you a sensible man who will withdraw to his obscurity. And I am grateful to you for a fascinating glimpse of what is best left alone. Could I have my wish, you would stay a while, and we would talk at length. But that would be risky to me and unkind to you. So let us store this afternoon, not among our memories, but among our fantasies. Lacey sat silent for a bit, until he drew breath and answered, Your Eminence is generous. How can you tell I won't betray your trust and seek elsewhere? Richelieu chuckled. Where else? You have called me unique. The Queen of Sweden has a penchant for curious characters, true. She is still a minor, though, and when she does take power, well, everything I know about her makes me warn you most sincerely to stay away. You are already aware of the hazards in any other country that matters. He bridged his fingers. In all events, he continued, didactic, your scheme was poor from the beginning, and my advice is that you abandon it forever. You have seen much history, but how much of it have you been? I suspect that I, in my brief decades, have learned lessons in which your nose was never rubbed. Go home. Then, I strongly suggest, make provision for your children and disappear with your friend. Take up a new life, perhaps in the new world. Remove yourself and me from temptation, remembering what my temptation is. For you dream a fool's dream. Why, Lacey croaked, have you not guessed? Really, I am disappointed in you. Hope has triumphed over experience. Hark back. Remember how kings have kept wild animals in cages and freaks at court? Oh, if I accepted you, I might be honest in my intentions, and Mazarin might be after me. But what of young Louis XIV, when he comes to his majority? What of any king, any government? The exceptions are few and fleeting. Even if you immortals were a race of philosophers who also understood how to rule me, do you suppose those who do rule would or could share power with you? And you have admitted you are only extraordinary in your lifespans. What can you become but animals in the royal menagerie, endlessly watched by the secret police and disposed of if you ever become inconveniently articulate? No, keep your freedom, whatever it costs you. You beg me to think about your proposal. I tell you to go and think about my counsel.
The clock ticked, the wind blew, the river flowed. From down in his throat, Lacey asked,
"Is this your Eminence's last word?"
"It is," Richelieu told him. Lacey rose.
"Best I leave," Richelieu's lips contorted. "I do wish I had more time to give you," he said, "and myself."
Lacey approached. Richelieu extended his right hand. Lacey bowed and kissed it. Straightening, he said, "Your Eminence is as great a man as I have ever met."
"Then God have mercy on humankind," Richelieu replied. "I shall never forget you. I will bear that in mind for as long as is granted me. Farewell, wanderer."
Lacey went to the door and locked. A guard opened it. Richelieu signaled him to let the man by and close it again. Thereupon he sat with his thoughts. The sunlight lengthened. The kitten woke, scrambled down his robe, and frisked off in its own life. Chapter 12 The Last Medicine. Over the plain from the north, the young men came a gallop. The haste and rhythm of it were like the ripples that went through the grass beneath the wind. Sunflowers here and there swayed the same lofty petals, as hot yellow as the light pouring across the world. Land and sky reached both unbounded. Green seemed to meet blue, but that was only at the edge of sight. Distance went on and on, farther than dreams could fly. A hawk row the air flows, dipping and soaring, his wings twin flames. A flight of marsh fowl lifted, so many that they darkened their quarter of heaven. Children set to keep crows out of the fields were first to see the young men. The oldest boy among them ran back to the village, filled with importance, for Deathless had ordered that he be told of the return. Yet when the boy had passed inside the stockade and was among the houses, his courage faltered. Who was he to speak to the mightiest of all shamans? Dared he risk interrupting a spell or a vision? Women at their work saw him stand forlorn. One hailed him, "Oh, hey, little hare, what is in your heart?" But they were only women. The old men he glimpsed were only old men, and surely this was a thing of terrible power if Deathless cared so much about it. The boy gulped and made for a certain house. Its dun sod loomed over him. When he came around its length to the front, the doorway gaped on a nightful cave where a single banked fire glimmered red. The families that shared it were elsewhere, doing their tasks, or, if they had none, taking their ease down by the river. One did remain, the person for whom little Hare had hoped, a man dressed in woman's clothes, grinding corn. He looked up and asked in his mild way, "What do you wish, lad?" Little Hare gulped. "The hunter's come back," he said. "Will you go tell the shaman three geese?" The noise of stone against stone ceased. The birdash rose. "I will," he replied. Such as he had some power against the unseen, perhaps because the spirits made up to them for their lack of manliness. Besides, he was a son of Deathless. He dusted meal off his buckskin, uncoiled his braids, and departed at a dignified pace. Little Hare gusted relief before he started back to his duty. Eagerness tingled in him. What a brave sight the riders would be when they went by! The shaman's house stood next to the medicine lodge at the middle of the village. It was smaller than the rest because it was only for him and his family. He was there just then with his wives. Copperbright, mother of three geese, sat on the ground outside watching over the two small daughters of Quailwing while they played in the sun. Bent, half-blind, she was glad she could still help this much at her great age. In the doorway, Rainet Evening, who had been born the same winter as the Burdash, helped a daughter of her own, Dawn Mist, ornament a dress with dyed quills for the maiden's forthcoming marriage. She greeted the newcomer, and, at his word, went inside to call her husband. Deathless came forth after a short while, still fastening his breech-clout. Young Quailwing peeped out from within, looking rumpled and happy.
"Oh, hey, father!"
said Three Geese, with due respect, but not the awe that was in the likes of Little Hare. After all, this man had dandled him when he was a baby, taught him to know the stars and how to set snares and everything else needful or delightful. And when it grew clear that the youth was not going to become fully a man, never lessened his love, but accepted the fact with the calm of one who had watched hundreds of lives blow past on the wind.
"They have seen Running Wolf's party on the way back to us."
Deathless stood quiet for a bit. When he frowned, a single wrinkle spread on his face. Sweat made his skin gleam over the springy muscles like dew upon rock. His hair was like the rock itself, polished obsidian.
"Are they sure that is who it is?"
he asked.
"Why, who else?"
replied Three Geese, astonished.
"Enemies. Raiders would not come so openly in broad daylight. Father, you have heard about the Pariki and their ways."
"Oh, true, I have," the shaman muttered, as if he had forgotten and needed reminding.
"Well, I must make haste now, for I want to speak to the hunters alone."
He went back into his house. Bradash and women exchanged looks where foreboding stirred. Deathless had spoken against the buffalo hunt, but Running Wolf had gotten his band together and left too swiftly for any real talk about it. Since then, Deathless had brooded, and sometimes taken elders aside, who afterward kept silence themselves. What did they fear? Soon Deathless reappeared. He had donned a shirt with strong signs burnt into the leather. White swirls of paint marked his countenance. A cap made from the pelt of a white mink encircled his brows. In his left hand he bore a gourd rattle, in his right a wand topped with a raven's skull. The rest stood aside, even the children gone silent. This was no longer the kindly, rather quiet husband and father they knew. This was he in whom a spirit dwelt, he who never grew old, he who during the ages had guided his folk and made them unlike any other. The hush followed him as he walked among the dwellings. Not every eye watched with the ancient reverence. Especially in the heads of boys, several smoldered. Through the open gate of the stockade he passed, and through the patches of corn, beans, and squash outside. The village stood on a bluff overlooking a broad, shallow river and the cottonwoods along the banks. Northward the ground sloped into gentle, rolling hugeness. Hereabouts short grass prairie gave way to tall grass plain. Shadows went mysterious over green waves. The hunters were now quite near. Earth drummed to hoofbeats. When he recognized the man afoot, Running Wolf signaled halt and reined in. His mustang whinnied and curvetted before standing quiet. Leggings held close against ribs, the rider sat the beast as if he had grown from it, or it from him. His dozen followers were nearly as skillful. Under the sun, men and horses alike blazed with life. In some hands were lances, on some shoulders hung bows and quivers. A knife of the finest flint rested at each waist. Headbands bore patterns of lightning bolt, thunderbird, hornet. From Running Wolf's, feathers of eagle and jay thrust upward. Did he think some day he would fly?
"Oh, hey, great one," he said reluctantly. "You honor us." "How went the chase?" asked Deathless.
Running Wolf gestured backward at the pack animals. They bore hides, heads, haunches, humps, entrails, umbles, lavishness that strained against rawhide lashings. Already as they rested, the grease and clotted blood were drawing flies. Exultance surged in his voice. "Never was such sport, never such slaughter.
We left more than this behind for the coyotes. Today the people feast. No, they gorge.
The spirits will punish wastefulness, Deathless warned. Running Wolf squinted at him while retorting,
What is Coyote not pleased that we feed his kind so well, too? And the buffalo are as many as the blades of grass.
A fire can blacken the land, and with the first rain it springs green anew.
Breath hissed between teeth when the leader thus dared interrupt the shaman, but none of the band were really shocked. Two grinned. Deathless ignored the breach, save that his tone grew harder still.
When the buffalo come by, our men go forth to take of them. First they offer the proper dances and sacrifices. Afterward I explain our need to the ghosts of the quarry, that they be appeased. So it has always been, and we have prospered in peace. Ill must come from leaving the ancient, proven path. I will tell you what atonement you can make, and lead you in it. And shall we then return to waiting until a herd drifts within a day's walk of here? Shall we try to cut a few out and kill them without any man getting gored or trampled? Or if we are lucky, may we stampede the whole herd over a drop and see most meat rot before we can eat it? If our fathers brought home little, it was because they could do no more, nor could the dogs draw much on their wretched travois.
Running Wolf's words came in spate, never hesitating. Clearly he had awaited this encounter some time upon his return, and planned what he would say.
"And if the new ways are unlucky," exclaimed Red Hawk, "why do the tribes that follow them flourish so mightily? Shall they take everything, and we pick the carrion bones?"
Running Wolf frowned at his follower and beckoned for silence. Deathless sighed. His response was almost gentle.
I foreknew you would speak like this. Therefore I sought you out where nobody else can hear. It is hard for a man to admit he has been wrong. Together we shall find how you can set things right and still keep your pride. Come with me to the medicine lodge, and we will seek a vision.
Running Wolf straightened, sheer against the sky.
Vision? He cried. I have had mine, old man, under the high stars, after a day when we raced with the wind. I saw riches overflowing, deeds men will remember longer than you yourself have lived and will live, glory, wonder. New gods are in the land, fiery from the hands of the Creator, and they ride on horses whose hoofs drum thunder and strike forth lightning. It is for you to make peace with them.
Deathless lifted his wand and shook his rattle. Unease crossed faces. The mounts felt it and snorted, shied, stamped.
"I meant no offense, Great One," Running Wolf said quickly. "You wish us to talk free of fear and of boasting alike, no? Well, if I got too loud, I'm sorry."
He tossed his head. "Nevertheless, the dream did come to me. I have told my comrades, and they believe." The magical thing sank earthward in the shaman's grasp. He stood for a little while unmoving, dark amidst the sunlight and grass, before he said low,
"We must talk further and try to learn the meaning of what has happened."
"Indeed we must." Relief made Running Wolf's tone kindly.
"Tomorrow. Come, Great One. Let me lend you this, my prize stallion, and I will walk while you ride into the village, and you will bless us there as you have always blessed the returning hunters."
"No." Deathless went from them. They sat mute, troubled, until Running Wolf laughed. He sounded like his namesake in wooded eastern country.
"The joy among our people will be blessing enough," he said, "and for us, the women, hotter than their fires."
Most of them had to force an echo of his mirth. However, the act heartened them. He at the forefront, they struck heels to flanks and pounded whooping ahead. When they passed the shaman, they never glanced his way. Upon his own entry, he found tumult. Folks seethed about the party, shouted, capered, exulted. Dogs clamored. The abundance was more than meat. It was fat, bone, horn, guts, sinew, all they needed to make nearly all they wanted. And this was the barest beginning. The hides would become coverings for teepees.
those that were not traded eastward for Poles, and then whole families could range as far and as long as they wished, hunt, butcher, tan, preserve on the spot, before going on to the next kill and the next...
Not overnight, Running Wolf cautioned.
Though he spoke weightily, his voice carried through the racket.
We have few horses yet, and first we must care for these that have served us.
Victory rang.
But we shall soon have more. Every man of us shall have his herd.
Somebody howled. Somebody else did likewise. And then the tribe was howling. His sign, his name, his leadership to be. Deathless went around them. Few noticed him. Those looked away, abashed, before throwing themselves the more wildly back into jubilance. The wives and youngest children of Deathless stood fast outside his house. There they could not see the crowd, but the cheers broke across them. Quailwing's gaze kept drifting yonder, wistfully. She was hardly more than a girl. He halted, confronted them, lips parted, but nobody had words.
You were good to wait here, he said at length. Now you may as well go join the rest. Help cook the food. Share in the feast.
And you? Asked Rain at evening, low.
I have not forbidden it, he said bitterly. How could I? You counseled against the horses. You counseled against the hunt, quavered Copperbright. What madness is in them that they no longer heed you?
They will learn better, Rain at evening avowed.
I am thankful I shall soon be snug in death.
Copperbright reached a gnarled hand toward Deathless. But you, poor darling, you must live through that lesson. Quailwing regarded her children and shuddered a little.
Go, said the man. Have pleasure. Also, it will be wise. We must not let the folk feel divided. That could well destroy them. I always strove to keep my people together.
Rain at evening considered him.
However, you will stay away, she asked. I will try to think what can be done, he answered, and went into the medicine lodge.
They lingered a bit, troubled, before leaving. His unsureness, the defiance of him, struck at the heart of everything by which they had lived. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch, and turn the cassette over.